More information is available at CranardCenter.com.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Pond. As you plan your year-end charitable giving, you may wish to consult your tax advisor about making a gift of appreciated stock or other property. As long as you have held that property for at least 1 year, you can deduct the full fair market value of the donation. Now, for more information about making a gift of appreciated property to WILL, give Don DeBeard a call at 217-333-1070. And thank you.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about a man who was maybe the most fascinating, certainly one of the most colorful and most controversial figures of the Victorian era. Sir Richard Francis Burton. He was a linguist, an explorer, an ethnographer, an author. He is today perhaps most remembered for his translation of the Arabian Nights, perhaps also of other books like the Kama Sutra. Also, people will know him as an explorer in Africa. He was many other things besides that. And most of the accounts of his life, if you read about him, portray him as a man who was in rebellion against the values of his time. However, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with an historian who makes a little bit different argument. He says that in many ways, Richard Burton was very much a Victorian, and by looking closely at his life, one may gain a broader view of the attitudes that were common in the Victorian world. Our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Dane Kennedy. He's professor of history and international affairs at George Washington University and is author of a recently published book about Richard Burton. It's titled The Highly Civilized Man, Richard Burton and the Victorian World. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Professor Kennedy, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well.
Well, thanks for talking with us. I have to admit that my first exposure, the first time that I discovered this man, was actually when I was a teenager and I happened to pick up Fawn Brody's biography of Burton, The Devil Drives,
right.
Which might have been sort of unlikely reading for a 16 or 17-year-old boy. And at the same time, though, the more I read about this man, the more I thought this had to be one of the coolest guys who ever lived.
Sure.
And it seems like everybody I talk to who knows who Richard Burton was says the same thing. And now I think I could gain a slightly more complex understanding of him, and still the 16-year-old boy in me thinks he was one of the coolest guys who ever lived. How did you become interested in Richard Burton yourself?
Well, I think in part through the same way you did. I mean, he's such an extraordinarily rich and complex and full figure whose life, you know, sort of extends in so many different realms it's hard not to be interested in him. And I think Fawn Brody's biography was the first one I read as well, and it is a terrific biography. So that was part of my interest. I have to say, in a professional sense, the other thing that drew me to him was a previous project I was working on about British India, and I was I came across his writings on India in that context, and got another sort of frame of reference for thinking about him.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the things that you read about him, and certainly the things that he wrote about himself, do show him, as you say, I think in the words that you put it here, that he's often portrayed as an heroic, independent spirit operating outside the bounds of social convention. At the same time, though, I think your main point is to say that, in fact, while he may have pushed the envelope in several ways, that he was, though, in many ways, very much a man of his time.
That's right. Part of the problem here is that we have our own sort of stereotypical view of who the Victorians were, and that is as much an invention of the generation that came after the Victorians as it is a real representation of them. And that stereotype, that invention, is that they were narrow-minded, pious, insular prudes, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept that view, then obviously someone like Burton has to be a figure outside his time, outside his society. But I think that we need to rethink, and there are others who have done this as well, rethink who the Victorians actually were. And part of that rethinking involves the appreciation of the degree to which the Victorians were involved in an enormous world of empire and trade and other forms of encounter. And probably the Victorians were encountering more peoples in more context than any previous generation in human history, literally across the globe. And that certainly brings them in contact with people, different values, different beliefs, different cultures, different habits, and the like. That's going to influence the way in which they think. It's going to reshape some of their values. And it's going to provoke a whole series of debates within British society itself about themselves and about their relationship to the rest of the world. So while, you know, Burton certainly is in some sense on the edge there, many of the ideas and the convictions that he represents and holds are held by others as well. I mean, he's a figure who's widely read, who's much admired by many of his contemporaries, who in fact, after all, is knighted near the end of his career by the Queen. And that I think tells us that he wasn't as much an outcast as he himself and many of his biographers like to portray him as being.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of photographs and paintings that were made of Burton during his lifetime, and they seem all to be very dramatic. Mm-hmm. He seems to be a man who liked to pose. Now, one photograph in particular that you have here early in the book, I think, is interesting. It's, and I'll try to describe it, I guess, as best I can. It's a photograph of Burton, and he's seated and he's wrapped up in some sort of it looks like it might be a blanket, maybe some very large cloak. He's all wrapped up, and all you can see of him is his head, essentially, and he's looking at the camera and has an almost, you know, slightly haunted look in his eye. And he, in fact, if someone put on the caption that he was ill at the time, physically ill, suffering some kind of tropical disease, you would buy that because of the way that he looks. So there's this very strange, and he's photographed against a completely plain backdrop. I don't know if it's a wall or something like that, but... Uh-huh. And the interesting thing about this is, as you know, that on his own copy, the copy of this picture that he kept for himself, he wrote underneath the picture the phrase, "the highly civilized man." What did he mean by that? What do you think he meant by
right,
that?
Right. Well, I think he actually had a contested view of civilization itself. His relationship with it was not a wholehearted embrace, and I think the phrase is dripping in irony. It's in part clearly a reference to himself. Here he is portrayed in a manner that is entirely at odds with what the Victorians would have regarded as the representation of a civilized man. I mean, just in terms of his look, in terms of his demeanor, in terms of his dress, all of that. By the same token, however, I think that it is as much a commentary on a society as it is on him. In other words, I think what he's doing is really questioning what civilization is, and it represents part of his broader challenge to the universalist claims that many Victorians were making about the superiority of their civilization and the benefits it could bring to the rest of the world. For him, that was always a problematic endeavor. Now, there's another dimension to the photograph as well, and that is the degree to which it shows his interest in self-representation and his interest in almost a kind of actorly portrayal. And he's a man who's always reshaping and refiguring himself and presenting a different guise of himself to the world. As you suggest, there are many other paintings and photographs of him, and they show him in different lights. And that that interest in identity and the ability to offer sort of different identities in different contexts is part of, I think, part of his appeal as a modern figure to us, and also really part of his appeal to many contemporaries as well. It's something and it also reflects back on the whole issue of civilization, because it destabilizes what we know as civilization. It sort of undermines sort of the premise that there's a certain clear set of standards by which we can measure civilization.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dane Kennedy. He's professor of history and international affairs at George Washington University and has authored a book about the Victorian era explorer, writer, translator, diplomat, Sir Richard Francis Burton, who was born in 1821. The book is titled The Highly Civilized Man, Richard Burton and the Victorian World, and the publisher on the book is Harvard University Press. Questions, so welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When Burton was a young man, he and his family moved around quite a lot, and he spent a lot of his growing up in Europe, so that I think it's true that by the time that he went to Oxford, to university, he had actually not spent very much of his life in actually had not spent much of his life in England, and he'd seemed somebody who in part never was completely comfortable with the society into which he had been born.
That's right. His relationship to England is really full of ambiguities. I mean, on the one hand, he clearly recognizes that the only real way in which he can make a success of himself, and he is a profoundly ambitious man, is through English society and through gaining the attention and notice of his fellow Englishmen. But by the same token, he's an expatriate. He's a man whose formative youth was spent primarily in France and in Italy. And in his short visits back to England, he found it a very alienating experience. He didn't like the food. He didn't like the customs. He didn't like the weather. He found it, here to get back to the issue of civilization, he found it in many ways not as civilized as Italy or France. I mean, when he was in Oxford, very briefly, he complained, for example, that they didn't have an opera company. He couldn't go to the opera, and the food was terrible. So he's pulled in two directions. He, on the one hand, recognizes that any chance of him achieving professional success has to come through England and accepting some of the premises and practices that exist there. And on the other hand, he doesn't like it very much. He definitely doesn't like it very much.
He wasn't at Oxford long. He was kicked out.
All right.
He was sent down in the parlance of the time.
Uh-huh.
And he ended up going to India as part of the East India Company's army. Now, there's an interesting notion for us nowadays, a private company that employs its own army. So in addition to being there being a regular British army, there was an East India Company army. And he was stationed in India, in northwestern India, and actually in a place that now is part of Pakistan. And this was a place where he very quickly began to learn the local languages and try to learn as much as he could about the people and their cultures. And this probably also was the place where he made some of his first journeys undercover. We put that in quotes, as he was sort of famous, very famous for doing later. Here, partly what he did was indeed in service to the empire, but in large part, this was something, his interest in learning about these people and their cultures, it seems that indeed it was something that he did for himself.
Oh, absolutely. It's I think, impossible to imagine someone like Burton immersing himself as deeply, as fully, as extensively as he does in Sindhi society in Western India without this appealing to some deep need in his own personality. And at the same time, it clearly is promoted by the British colonial government itself, which desperately needs information and intelligence about the peoples that they're now governing. He spends most of his time in an area, as you say, in what is now Pakistan, in Sindh, that had just been conquered by the British in 1842. And they don't know much of anything about this place. And so it's vitally important for them to develop and acquire as much information as they can. And that means they have to get people who can learn, first and foremost, the local languages. And here's where Burton's first strength really comes to the fore. He clearly had linguistic ability, remarkable linguistic abilities, you know, as a youth in Italy and Spain, he'd learned languages there. But once he gets to India, that becomes formalized, and the British East India Company itself encourages its officers to learn local languages and has a series of exams in them, and the more exams you can pass, the more opportunities for promotion. So he takes that avenue to success. And at the same time, I mean, doing it for professional purposes, he also does it for personal purposes because he clearly is enamored with the world that he encounters there. He's fascinated by the social practices. He's immersed in the religious beliefs. He, in effect, probably becomes something of a Sufi, which was the predominant form of Islam in Sindh at the time. And he spends a good deal of time wandering through the countryside in disguise, as he says, trying to immerse himself in that society. Now, partly, as I said, he does that, it's been argued by some, as a kind of secret agent, but I think he does it even more simply because this is what he enjoys.
Yeah, he had this lifelong interest and fascination with Indian, Hindu, Persian, Arab culture.
Yes.
And traveled a great deal in these places and wrote a lot about his travels and wrote about those cultures and had, as one of the things that people perhaps will know about them, that he had seemed to have exceptional interest in sexual behavior and wrote a lot about those things.
Uh-huh.
How is it, though, at the point where he joins up with the East India Company's army and goes to India, how is it that he went there? I mean, was it an actual purposeful kind of decision that's the place that he wanted to go as opposed to someplace else?
You mean to India?
India.
Oh, yes. Well, there were really only two options if he wanted to enter the military. One was to join the British Army, which would have, in fact, been quite expensive and difficult. The cheaper option, and the one that also offered greater opportunities for promotion, was to enter the British East India Company Army, and that would have sent him to India. Of course, if he had entered the regular army, he might have spent some time in India as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this would have been the principal option available to him for a military career. And he's the son of an army officer, so this is a career path that seems logical to him, and also ultimately to his father. Although his father did hope that he'd actually become a clergyman and he'd stick it out in Oxford, but once that option clearly had gone by the wayside, this made good sense. Hmm. I think for both of them.
So I gather that this would have been a time when, if you were going to go into the officer corps of the regular army, you still would have had to purchase your commission?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes. And even for the Indian Army, although supposedly there was no purchase, his family did pay some money, sort of under the table.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that.
Great.
In Mahomet community, not far from here, on our line number one. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating show, fascinating subject. Two things I was wondering. One, do you know if Sir Richard ever traveled through the Balkans at all?
Well, I'm trying to. No, probably not. He did serve in the Crimean War, but I don't believe it was in the Balkans.
Do I get another question then?
Sure.
I wondered, when you're talking about him being in the Sindh and such, was he the inspiration, or do we have any idea that he might be inspiration for Kipling's character, the Great Game?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on this point and some debate. Certainly, Isabel Burton, Richard's wife, made this claim later on, and some others have as well. The stuff I've read, however, suggests that there was a more direct model for coupling, and it was a contemporary British policeman in the area who did, in fact, assume disguises. In fact, assuming disguises was not all that uncommon for the British in India and the Northwest Provinces.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Thanks for the call. Other questions? 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The thing that made Burton famous, initially the thing that made him famous, mm-hmm. was the pilgrimage to Mecca. He went in 1853 on Hajj in disguise and wrote about it afterwards, and it really made him rather famous and made him a celebrity. The interesting thing here that you point out, that other people have pointed out, is that if Burton had been a Muslim, he could have gone as himself. He would not have had to go in disguise and go through all this business of putting on the costume and assuming this identity and taking the risks, and indeed there were risks, of going. He even had himself circumcised to make the disguise as complete as possible, which goes back again to some of these questions about his interest in acting and putting on costumes and putting on other identities. One also wonders, and I think you raised the question too, just how thoroughly his impersonation went and uh-huh. whether or not, in fact, there were people who suspected and he was not who he was passing himself off to be. Uh-huh. Maybe you could talk about the trip to Mecca and what that tells us. You know, what does it tell us about Burton, but does that tell us anything more than that?
Okay, yeah. Well, he had spent about 7-8 years in India and had returned back to Europe on a medical leave. And he clearly didn't want to return to India, or at least not to the India that was becoming much more bureaucratized, as he saw it. He published 4 books about his Indian experiences in the course of 2 years, which gives you, I think, some measure of sort of the intellectual dynamism of the man. And then was looking for another option. And the option that came to mind arose as a result of an announcement by the Royal Geographical Society that they would help to finance a trip into Arabia. Now, initially the idea was that the traveler would make the journey across the empty lands from west to east or vice versa to try to scout out new territories. So he got the position, and but he also didn't get as much time, much leave, as much of a leave from the British East India Company Army as he had hoped. So his plans changed. They also changed because he came to realize that traveling literally across Arabia was just not feasible. And he decided instead to make this journey to Mecca and Medina, disguised as a Sufi of Pathan origin. The Pathans were a tribal people in the hills of Sindh. Now, it takes a while, in fact, for him to develop the disguise that he ultimately hits on. He goes through 3 variants of a persona, initially on the trip to Cairo, and then while he's in Cairo, and finally hits upon sort of a impression that he thinks will be successful. And I think what's particularly interesting and what often gets lost in accounts of this journey is that the challenge for him is as much with the British public at home as it is with the people he encounters on this journey, as you suggested, and as I try to suggest in the book. I think there's some evidence that some of his travel companions probably actually knew he wasn't who he purported to be, but they were fine with that. And as you said, if he had simply declared himself to be a Muslim and gone as an English Muslim, that would have been fine as well. But the fact of the matter is, if he had done that, he couldn't have gone back to England and acquired the kind of fame and prestige that he had acquired, because, in fact, he would have been regarded as a religious renegade. He would have been regarded as having gone native. So the real challenge for him was to assume a disguise that would persuade the public back at home that he could in fact represent himself as a Muslim and make this journey into the secret heart of Islam, and at the same time still profess to be an Englishman, which of course he had certain ambivalence about in any case. Now, his religious beliefs at this time are also really in question. He may have been as sympathetic to, probably was in many respects, more sympathetic to Islam than he was to Christianity. But that, too, was something that had to be sort of underplayed when he was representing this journey to a British public. So he's dealing not just with the challenge of assuming a disguise for the people he encounters on this journey, but also sort of representing himself in a particular way for the British public at home. And that's, in many ways, the biggest challenge, I think, that he faces. And it's a challenge that continues later in his career as more and more people think that, well, maybe he actually has gone native and he really has converted to Islam and he really isn't one of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that that's the kind of question that people asked about him from the very beginnings, when he was in the East India Company's army in Sindh. I think even then, mm-hmm. probably there were people who knew him, his contemporaries, people who he served with, who thought even then he had gone native.
That's right. That's right. And that's the dilemma that he constantly faces in the effort to sort of engage in this immersion in another culture. I mean, the very fact that you enter into it to the degree that he does and enter into the most intimate elements of that other society immediately raises questions among your own contemporaries about your loyalties. All right? And it certainly was true in his relationship with some of his fellow officers, although I must say that his commanders didn't feel that way. He got good recommendations. To judge from the official record, he was admired for what he was doing. But there were always people who were going to be suspicious of this.
And also, I suppose we should consider that he, all along, even as he wrote about his experiences in India, it seemed to be in Burton's own interest to promote this outsider image. So, in fact, he might mm-hmm. have pushed it a little bit more than it actually was, because much of what we would know about that, yes, as you say, there is an official record, but also part of the record is his own account of his experiences.
That's right. And it's part of this issue of a performance and how far you can go with a performance. He's engaging in a certain kind of theater, it's a very high stakes game, because at what point do you sort of push it a little too far? Well, he pushes it about as far as you possibly can, and certainly there are many contemporaries who think he's actually gone over to the other side.
Yeah. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get right to. I would like to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dane Kennedy. He's professor of history and international affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, which is in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about the life of the Victorian era writer, explorer, translator, Richard Francis Burton. And if you're interested in reading some more about him and about his place in the Victorian era, you can look at the book that our guest has authored. It's titled The Highly Civilized Man, Richard Burton and the Victorian World, published by the Harvard University Press. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that now in Champaign County, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just an aside to start with, which is that corporate armies, plus ça change, maybe another show. You're sort of holding him up as an exemplar of Victorian England, but at the same time, you said he was alienated himself. So he's an outsider there as well, apparently, from what you're saying, and that made him travel well, I suppose, because he wasn't really Victorian. There's the whole body of talk about Orientalism, and I think Burton is cited as it, but he obviously knew the difference between, you know, going to Saudi Arabia and being in Sindh, where I don't know if at the time they had Devadisa is a, I guess it's a Hindi word for temple prostitute. So they had a different kind of orientation towards sexuality. And I guess I'm getting at the question of him as a sex tourist or something, or how you sort all of that out in some way. But you know, the major point is that you point out that he can't really be an exemplar of Victorian society because he was, well, you said, raised mainly in Italy, huh?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, certainly his relationship to England is an ambivalent one, but I think a lot of the ideas and the values that he articulates are ideas and values that were shared by a variety of others in Victorian society. I just the point then is that I think we need to escape the rather simplistic stereotyped view of who the Victorians were. But specifically on your question about sexuality, sex fascinated Burton, sex in all its varieties, and it clearly fascinated him from the beginning. His very first book, a book called Goa and the Blue Mountains, includes a chapter where he visits a village in the outskirts of Portuguese Goa called Sarota. Which is a village that trains dancing girls, but in fact dancing girls who were quasi prostitutes as well, and he makes it pretty evident that he's going there in effect as a kind of sex tourist. And throughout his travels, and I think it's important to keep in mind that I mean he travels to an extraordinary array of the world, in India and Middle East, East Africa, West Africa, South America, North America, and the like. He's constantly on the lookout for different sexual practices, and he has what he would regard as a kind of anthropological interest in these issues, but obviously it extends beyond simply a kind of scientific curiosity. It reflects a deep interest in his own part, and it ultimately translates, obviously, into his later publications, the Kama Sutra, the Anangaranga, the Perfumed Garden, and his translation of the Arabian Nights itself, which was highly unexpurgated and which included a rather famous or notorious essay on what he termed pederasty. So, yes, sexuality was an issue that preoccupied him to a very great extent, and was one of the ways in which he sort of challenged what he regarded as certain norms of the Victorians, although in this regard, too, I would say that part of this is a reflection of shifts that are taking place in the late 19th century when he publishes the Kama Sutra and the like, when there's a revival of a kind of purity movement that hadn't existed earlier. But I don't know. Does this answer your question?
Yeah, well, why did they call it a purity movement? I don't understand quite. You're saying that was part of that? I mean, I guess I read a little bit of Lytton Strachey in the undercurrent of the Victorian era. Every mm-hmm. era has an undercurrent. But I also wanted to emphasize the point about how, you know, it's when in the so-called West we so-called totalize the Orient and we lump everything in together from mm-hmm. a culture that's very free and open with sexuality to, you know, Saudi Arabia, which I'm sure wasn't, except it probably had its own undercurrents too, which I don't know if Burton ever wrote about that, but...
Saudi Arabia, no, but certainly he spent some time in the red light districts of Cairo, which he much enjoyed. But yes, you're quite right. I mean, there are immense varieties of practices. Burton is an Orientalist in the academic British sense of someone who acquires learning about other societies, and particularly linguistic knowledge. But he would never, I think, have engaged in the kind of totalizing claims about the Orient that Edward Said criticized in his book Orientalism.
Yeah, I guess that's where people like him like me that haven't actually read him, and probably the people that would object to even, you know, opening the book before making a judgment on it. I guess I'll leave it there.
All right. Well, thanks for that call.
Oh, thank you.
We have, in the way that we have been talking about him, I think it becomes very obvious that we're talking about an individual who, in whose personality and identity there were many contradictions.
Sure.
And I want to get at another one of them, because in talking about, which might be a little bit surprising, because as you have said, he was, for example, very sympathetic to Islam. He was very interested in Hinduism and in Indian culture and in Persia, and in the way that he wrote about these people and their cultures and their practices, there seemed to be, he didn't write about it from a point of view that I, as an Englishman or European, am somehow the embodiment of a superior culture looking down on one that's inferior. You don't get that kind of sense. However, he did travel in Africa, and he wrote about Africa and Africans. And in that writing, it seems that he was clearly and unabashedly racist in his attitudes towards Africans, towards black Africans. He even went to the point of defending slavery.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, and in that sense, I suppose, in that sense that he felt that somehow there was a hierarchy of races, and that no doubt he would think that white Europeans were on the top and that black Africans were on the bottom. And that certainly was representative of the attitudes of his time. So in that sense, he was very much in harmony with his time. But it seems to be out of keeping with the way that he thought about other peoples who were not European. In a way, it just doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't fit.
Right. Well, there are two issues here. First of all, about him being in harmony with his times. Certainly, racism was much more prevalent than it is today. But it's also important to keep in mind that he's engaged in a great debate with many of his contemporaries, exactly over this question, because there are a number of Victorians who reject the kind of racism that he articulates and that some of his contemporaries articulate. This is one of the sort of fracture points, I think, of Victorian society, and one of the features of that debate is over the degree to which, in fact, the variety of peoples around the globe can be seen as sharing some common features, and the degree to which they can all be incorporated in the kind of universalist values that some Victorians hold dear, and that includes things like Christianity, monogamy, and so on. Burton's insistence upon cultural difference, if you will, also includes this claim for racism. Now, the issue of slavery, too, is interesting in this regard. Yes, he's a defender of slavery. In the context of Islamic societies, that would have been perfectly sensible and a reasonable position to hold. So it isn't inconsistent with his views on Islam at that point. But, yes, he is a ferocious racist. He is one of the most outspoken racists of the 19th century. More particularly, he is one of the mid-19th century's most determined advocates of a new kind of scientific racism, which holds that the differences between people are innate, they are immutable, they're biological. Now, how he comes to those views are interesting, and there are all sorts of complex cross currents that are operating there that account for them. One of the issues, a personal element in this transition, I think, comes about as a result of his first exploration in Black Africa, which occurs in Somalia in 1855, 2 years after he has made the epic journey to Mecca and Medina. Here he again attempts to travel in disguise, in this case as a Muslim trader. But on this occasion, it doesn't do him any good. His dress, his languages, his facility with dress, language, custom, and the like simply are not enough to gain him access to these peoples that he's encountering on these journeys. suddenly skin color holds an importance that it had not held before. And I think one of the, and the result is that in this journey, he eventually abandons the disguise. It just isn't going to work, and he dispenses with it, and he presents himself as a British officer. In his subsequent journey in East Africa, he did the same thing, as well as in his travels through West Africa. Now, I think this new importance that physical appearance, physical features acquires for him in the outgrowth of that journey certainly is one of the factors that causes him to place emphasis upon race as a biological characteristic. It also, however, comes about in part in his debate with the Christian universalists within his own society, who were saying that we can make Africans into people like us. And he said, no, you can't, and because they're distinct and they're inferior. It's the challenge with someone like Burton, I think, is that he cuts across so many of those categories that seem natural and evident and logical in our own society. And the problem then is to see how those views can be consistent within his own mind and within the minds of many of his contemporaries. And I think there is some degree of consistency, but like all of us, there are some contradictions as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Well, I hate to take it back to sex, but I understand I know that the Perfumed Garden is very, very explicit, and I believe the Kama Sutra is too. I just can't visualize how these two questions, and then I'll hang up. I can't visualize how these translations were circulated. Were they treated as pornography or what? And mm-hmm. then number two, I was wondering if Richard Burton, and at the end of his life, or any time after he'd done these major translations and so on, had kind of summarized or expressed a preference for one point of view over another, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. They're two good questions. As for the letter question, certainly his interests at the very end of his life were focused on male homosexuality. Now, does that mean he was himself a homosexual? I don't know. My general sense, I mean, there's certainly plenty of evidence that he enjoyed the affection of women. My general sense is that he was interested in sexuality of all sorts, but homosexuality was a subject that preoccupied him toward the end. Now, how did he publish these books? It's a good question. They would have been and were, in fact, regarded by a number of Victorians as pornographic. And the only way in which he was able to get them published was, in fact, to publish them privately and to market them through the mails. In other words, they couldn't have been sold openly in bookstores. Moreover, he had to publish them anonymously. His name was not attached to any of these works, which were all translations, of course, because they were, in fact, seen as too explicit and too controversial. Now, in his own mind, he was convinced that what he was doing was bringing a new kind of sexual knowledge to the West and to a British society that was too prudish and too controlling in its attitudes towards sexuality. He referred to this as the forces of Mrs. Grundy. That was his sort of nickname for these elements of prudery and censorship. So he saw himself in a great battle with these elements. In that sense, he represented himself as an opponent of Victorianism. But I would argue that in fact these forces of censorship were becoming more dominant, more forceful toward the end of the 19th century than they had been earlier, and that there was a great debate within Victorian society itself over precisely this issue. So he presents himself as an anti-Victorian in this regard, but I think he's still very much a Victorian in terms of the struggle over how much knowledge one should have about sex.
So we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe 3-4 minutes left, and I want to go back to the point we talked a little bit about the beginning, or at least I mentioned you're making the argument that by looking at this man and looking at his life, what he thought about himself, what people thought about him, that it can perhaps give you a larger, better, more nuanced understanding of Victorians and of this time. So maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. Well, you know, it seems to me that one of the ways in which Burton offers a glimpse into some of the larger issues about his larger features of his society, and for that matter, not just his own, I think are reflective of ours in some ways, is insofar as he's engaged in the effort to try to understand the nature of a variety of differences and how to sort of distinguish difference. I'm referring here to, for example, sexual difference, the interest in homosexuality as a different form of sexuality, the interest in religious difference, the distinctions between Islam and Hinduism and Christianity and the like, racial difference, another category of difference that is very much a preoccupation for him, but it's a preoccupation for so many of his contemporaries. There's this great debate that's going on among the Victorians about where one draws the line between us and them, if you will. What distinguishes our values, our practices from those of the many other peoples that we're encountering in this world of expanding trade and empire. And that's what makes, I think, Burton such a compelling figure for so many of his contemporaries, a controversial one, to be sure. Many people were outraged by what he said, but there were plenty of them who also were very admiring of his positions on so many of these issues. And I think that this debate among the Victorians about difference is one that has its residues with us. I mean, we're still in many respects engaged in a similar kind of debate when we talk about issues like multiculturalism or about sort of the clash of civilizations. These are all issues that are framed around the way in which we draw differences between peoples, right? By the same token, the preoccupation with globalization is a preoccupation with an effort to sort of in the views of many of its critics and many of its supporters, too, to erase difference, to bring about a more homogeneous world than had existed in the past. And so on this level, it seems to me that what Burton is doing on an intellectual frame of reference is something that speaks to the concerns of his own age and something that I think can resonate with ours as well.
Hmm. Well, I think it's interesting that they, as I've said, and you agreed that definitely he's a man with many contradictions, and that on the one hand he embraced some cultures and was very sympathetic to some cultures and some people other than his own, and in other senses was I don't know, hostile is the right word, but again, going back to clearly his attitudes about black Africans that were racist, and also later in his, at least later in his life, if not earlier, there seemed to be a pronounced anti-Semitism that also came out. So that here we see someone who is a very complicated mix of clearly racist kind of thinking on the one hand, and yet on the other, in his cataloging of some other cultures and getting to know them, there did seem to be a strong sort of relativism, a sort of way of saying, well, you know, this is this culture and this is this culture, and there are a lot of different cultures, and they're all different, and one necessarily better. Although he might indeed make the argument that some of the cultures that were some of the non-European cultures he came into contact with might have been better, but that he seems this interesting sort of mix of the two. And I wonder, does, on balance, did he and did his work and did his writing push the idea of multicultural, what we would now call multiculturalism or cultural relativism, at all? Did it actually advance the cause of multiculturalism?
Well, you know, it Burton is one of these figures who's known in a variety of different contexts. And so, for example, among African historians, he's known as a racist. Among Islamicists, he's known as someone who is really a kind of relativist, who's very sympathetic to Islamic societies and cultures. So as you say, there are these contradictions or these challenges. Maybe one way to get at this issue, even in the context of his views about Africans, it seems to me that his racism evolves or sort of has some connection to a kind of relativism in this sense. I mean, racists would say what you need to do is keep black Africans in their place. Relativists would say that black Africans have a place which has merits of its own. So both positions are in agreement, in opposition to those who seek to sort of transform Africans, to improve them, to make them more like Europeans. Now, Burton is, in this sense, both a racist and a relativist. He does believe that blacks are inferior, and at the same time, he actually has a great deal of interest in and admiration for those African cultures that he comes into contact with. Does it make him a multiculturalist? Boy, I don't know.
we're going to have to, my apologies for jumping in here, but we're going to have to, that's a good point to end, and we must, because we ended the time, at the end of the time. The book is The Highly Civilized Man, Richard Burton and the Victorian World, published by Harvard University Press. Our guest, Dane Kennedy, Professor of History, International Affairs, George Washington University. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership at the University of Illinois, a resource for UIUC faculty and students with entrepreneurial ideas and aspirations. More information on the Academy can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about silent movies. Our guest will be writer and editor Peter Cobell. He and the Library of Congress have collaborated on a new illustrated history of the silent film, the title Silent Movies, The Birth of Film and the Triumph of Movie Culture. Peter Cobell will join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat, 973, that down 6. In Chicago, December wheat, 932, down 2. March, 963, up 22.5. May, 963, up 20. December corn, 421, up 4.25. March, 437.75, up 4.5. May, 448.5, up 4.25. December of 08, 451.5, that up 2.25. January beans, 1160, up 8.5. March, 1178.5, up 7.75. May, 1191.5, up 8.25. November, 1063.5, that contract down 0.75. December meal, 323.60, up 4.10. December oil, 46.12, down 13. At the Merck in Chicago, January feeder cattle, 103.75, down 145. March, 105.85, down 130.